This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. You know, when we listen to a story, we're interested first in how it begins. Then we want to know what happens next and what is its significance. We may also ask, could it have ended differently? What are the lessons of this story? On the program today, we'll ask those questions as we take a fresh look at an early American story. Our guest is historian Nathaniel Philbrick, the author most recently of Mayflower, a story of courage, community, and war. The war was King Philip's War, a war largely forgotten today, but Philbrick argues it was a pivotal time in the history of North America. It began in 1675, 54 years after the Mayflower's landing. Who was King Philip? He was the son of Massasoit, a Native American leader at the time of the Mayflower's landing. Nathaniel Philbrick says the 14-month-long war changed the face of New England. 5,000 died, three-quarters of them Native Americans. Other Native Americans were enslaved. Philbrick writes in this book, Mayflower, that it had taken 56 years to unfold, but one people's quest for freedom had resulted in the conquest and enslavement of another. Listeners, I invite your questions this afternoon for Nathaniel Philbrick. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Nathaniel Philbrick, welcome back to the Afternoon Magazine. Nice to talk with you.
It's great to be here.
Well, let's begin maybe with a big question, and then we can go back and talk about some of the characters, the principles, and how this story unfolded. What have we lost, do you think, by losing this part of our history, by surrendering to romantic fantasy in terms of who we think of when we think of the Pilgrims?
Yeah. Well, I think we've really lost a lot of ourselves. We're a relatively young nation, and beginnings are very important to us. And for so long, we've had this myth of origins, the voyage of the Mayflower and the celebration of the first Thanksgiving a year later, which, you know, like any myth, there's a real kernel of truth there. But the fact of the matter is there's so much more occurred in the 17th century that makes what happened at this time something more than a romantic exception to the turbulent and often dark history of our land. What happened in the first 55 years of Plymouth Colony, in many ways, is a remarkable anticipation of what would happen in America as it relentlessly pushed west in the 19th century. So I think ultimately, this is a story that has so much more relevance for us once we begin to see how it really unfolded after that first Thanksgiving.
Yeah, and these were real-life people. That is also something we've lost sight of.
Absolutely. You know, I know when I first learned about the Pilgrims in elementary school, they were papier-mâché saints, symbols of fortitude and piety, who met generous Native Americans, and you know, it was this wonderful tableau and a great lesson for elementary school kids. But you know, I think we owe it to our kids, and particularly as they become teenagers in high school and then later in college, to say, wait a minute, there's a lot more to this story, and these were people, and ordinary people under extraordinary circumstances.
Yeah. Well, they were ordinary people, the Pilgrims, I'm thinking of here now, they were ordinary people who were radicals.
Yes. I mean, and that's the thing. We're taught they came to America in search of religious freedom. And that just isn't the case. These were Puritan separatists, which was the radical fringe of the Puritan movement, who believed that the Church of England was not a holy church and that they must separate. They must be by themselves if they were going to worship the Lord as he intended. So they came to America to escape King James and his bishops, to do as they saw fit. And when later in the century, when other groups came to New England, they were persecuted. For example, the Quakers were not allowed to set up shop in New England. And you know what these people believed was their way was the right way, and they were looking for an opportunity to do that, and were not interested in extending that freedom to others.
Yeah, and even the Pilgrims that were on the Mayflower, they had their differences. There were two groups.
Yeah, and that's another complexity to it that is really essential to the story, because I think it relates so much to what America would become. It wasn't just a group of Puritan separatists aboard the Mayflower. Almost half the ship were what they referred to as the strangers. These were potential settlers recruited in London who were, by and large, from the members of the Church of England, who didn't necessarily sympathize with the radicalism of the Pilgrims, the Puritans' religious beliefs, and so there was this divide from the very beginning. And actually, when the Mayflower was approaching America, it was realized that they were going to settle 200 miles north of where they originally intended, at the Hudson River, there was a insurrection aboard the Mayflower. As the stranger said, "Wait a minute! If we're going to become America's first illegal aliens, we don't need to go with this group of religious radicals." And so, the Mayflower Compact was written in which everyone agreed to a form of civil government, which was a big step for the Puritan separatists.
Yeah. Now, you use the politically charged term illegal aliens, but they had a patent to go to the Hudson River,
right?
Not to New England.
That's right, and so their legal paperwork, their documentation, did not apply when it was decided that they must go to New England, and you know, so this is a complexity that is you know, I think we can all relate to today when it comes to trying to define what America is as a people. From the very beginning, there were issues of you know, is this legal to go here? And the Pilgrims decided, well, we'll go there and make it work legally later on.
Hmm. The Mayflower Compact, what was in it? How significant was it?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a tendency, given the future direction of America, to see it as the U.S. Constitution in utero. It was not that, but it was still an extraordinary document. It was based on, in large part, on a letter written by the Puritan separatist minister, John Robinson, who remained in Leiden, Holland, where they had been in religious exile for more than a decade. And he had written a letter telling the members of his congregation aboard the Mayflower that, you know, don't prejudge the strangers. You've got to get along if this is going to work. And it's clear that some of his phraseology made its way into the Mayflower Compact, in which this group of very different peoples agreed to submit to the laws enacted by their duly elected officials. And so, you know, this was civil government, and it really made possible the future success of Plymouth Colony.
Yeah. Now, what if they had not come to that agreement?
If they hadn't, one option would have been for the Puritan separatists to look to their military officer, Miles Standish, to subdue the rebels. And, you know, and this would have been, I think, a very dark and disturbing beginning to this settlement. And if they had gone their separate ways, there's no way they would have survived even a few months in the New World. And so, you know, this was a very pragmatic document in many ways. You know, instead of resorting to force, they put pen to paper and drafted the Mayflower Compact.
Yeah, their situation upon landing was quite precarious,
yeah.
Wasn't it? What was it?
Well, you know, it was a survival situation absolutely from the start. The Mayflower was poorly provisioned. They ended up making landfall 200 miles off course and knew nothing about where they were. And so they spent several precious months searching for a settlement site. And what made it even worse is that they had fallen prey to a host of delays as they were leaving England, and so that they didn't arrive until November, months after they should have been there. And it wasn't really till December that they settled on Plymouth Harbor. And as soon as they started a settlement there, people began to succumb to disease. And by the end of the winter, 55 of 102 passengers would be dead.
What were their expectations of the settlement site, given that they were expecting to go to the Hudson River?
Yeah, well, you know, they really didn't know what to make of where they were going. And their big question was, what about the native peoples here? What is their attitude going to be? You know, they had some sense of the Hudson River. They had lived in Holland, and the Dutch had already been beginning to investigate this area. But New England was a question mark. There were some maps available and things like that, but it was the native people that they didn't know, and early on they spotted some Indians up ahead, and there's this wonderful description of Miles Standish leading his small band of pilgrims in a run down the beach trying to catch up to the Indians, who immediately run away. And it would become a kind of game of cat and mouse when they would find a storage pit of corn, native corn, and this created a real conundrum. What should we do? Maybe our wheat and barley won't grow in these alien soils. Maybe we need this corn, but if we steal it, what will the local Indians think? And they decided to steal it, and this was not the way to ingratiate themselves with the local populace.
Yeah. What can you tell us about the native people living in this area when the Mayflower landed?
Yeah, we now refer to them as the Wampanoag in the southeastern Massachusetts. And for the 3 years that the Pilgrims had been planning this expedition, the Indians in this region had been beset by a series of terrible diseases that in some cases killed 90% of the Native Americans in the area where the Pilgrims would settle. Plymouth Harbor had been host to a community of around 2,000, and when the Pilgrims arrived, there was no one there, just the whitened bones of the dead along the shore. And their leader, Massasoit, realized that his people were in terrible straits because their neighbors, the Narragansetts, their traditional foes, had been unaffected by these diseases and were threatening to take them over. And so they were, the Wampanoags were in a survival situation, as were the Pilgrims. And it would be Massasoit's decision to look to the English, even though they were clearly a very weak settlement, as a possible ally, as a way to resuscitate his people's fortunes relative to the Narragansetts.
Now, prior to the Mayflower's landing, what had their experience been with Europeans?
Well, you know, there for decades, European fishermen, cod fishermen, had been appearing off the shores of New England from the Cape Cod up to Maine in the spring and summer for years. And there had been English explorers coming through, as well as the French. And in fact, one English explorer several years before the arrival of the Pilgrims had abducted some Native Americans that included Squanto, the famous translator. And Squanto had ended up back in London, learned the English language, and then just before the arrival of the Pilgrims had made his way back to his home in Plymouth Harbor, which he referred to as Patuxet, as the interpreter to yet another English explorer, and seeing that, you know, his people had suffered this terrible loss, and he began to realize that, you know, if an English settlement should ever take root in this place, he would be uniquely situated to profit from it, because he, as a translator, he could tell Massasoit what he wanted him to think the English were saying, and he could tell the English what he wanted them to think the Indians were saying, and that would prove the case.
How human is that? Self-interest.
Self-interest, exactly. Self-interest and a tremendous amount of complexity when it came to the Native American situation and sophistication. And you know, and what Squanto would do is he had ambitions to become the next Massasoit. And he began to tell Indians in the region that the Pilgrims possessed the plague, that it was buried underneath their house, one of their houses, in a barrel, and that they could unleash it at will. And since Squanto was their interpreter, he could control what happened there. And so Indians in the region began to look to Squanto for protection rather than Massasoit. It took about a year for both Massasoit and the Pilgrims to realize what Squanto was up to. And when it was revealed, Massasoit was justifiably angered, insisted literally on the head of Squanto, but But William Bradford, by then governor of Plymouth Colony, was reluctant to give up his interpreter. He thought he needed him, and this almost ruined the alliance. It would calm down, and things would go on track largely because Squanto would die soon after, perhaps the victim of a poisoning on the part of Massasoit.
You know, the Puritans had endured a long and frightening voyage. There was conflict on board. When they landed, it was near winter. Illness and death immediately set in. What sustained them through this period?
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. For one thing, their spiritual beliefs. And if you look at any kind of survival situation, people who are held together by ties of family and shared religious beliefs have a stronger likelihood of surviving a survival situation. And this proved true with the Pilgrims to a large extent. And, you know, the other thing is that, you know, their spiritual beliefs were sustaining them, but they also had good leaders. John Carver was their first governor, and he did a lot to pull them together initially, but he died. He was one of the ones who died fairly late in the season, and it would be William Bradford who would take over. And William Bradford, in many ways, is the man who saved the colony. He would end up being governor of Plymouth Colony for the majority of the first half century of the colony, and he was a man of extraordinary sympathy, and yet capable of strong decisions, and he had strong religious beliefs, but he was able to win over many of the strangers ultimately. John Alden appears to have been a very pivotal character. He had come over as a cooper, a barrel maker aboard the Mayflower, and decided to stay. And at one point, he came over to the separatist side, and that was a key transformation. And so, after this terrible year of hardship, it created a kind of bond between saint and stranger alike. And with Bradford as a strong leader, the colony developed a sense of cohesion that it hadn't had aboard the Mayflower.
Yeah, and he had to endure the death of his wife.
Right, and this is where, these are people enduring incredible situations. Bradford was part of three different exploring voyages looking for a settlement site soon after the arrival of the Mayflower. And each one of these were very arduous. They finally find Plymouth Harbor, and they return to the Mayflower, and Bradford discovers that his wife Dorothy has slipped over the side of the Mayflower and drowned while he was gone. And a terrible setback, and one of the things, no one knows exactly what happened because Bradford would never write about it, but it has been speculated that she may have committed suicide. And no matter what her motivations or lack of motivations were, this was a terrible setback for Bradford, who was soon after looked to lead this colony.
What sustained the native people through their dark period, 1616 through 1619, when so many of them died from plague?
Well, you know, that's a very good question, and it points to a aspect of the story that is a challenge for anyone trying to tell it. Is that, you know, the evidence we have from the English is fairly extensive, the evidence we have from the Indians is not as extensive, most of it comes through the English, and yet, you know, what you do see is that those 3 years were just a terrible time. I mean, can you imagine losing 90% of your population? I mean, this was a terrible time for all of them, and made them a real husk of what they had been by the time the Pilgrims arrived, and it created not only all of this death, but it destabilized the region, where groups that had been uneasy neighbors in the best of times broke into what were described as civil dissensions and bloody wars. And so this was just a terrible time of dislocation and loss. And I think it's very interesting that Massasoit looks to this arrival of the Pilgrims as a way to help lead his people out of this terrible trauma. And to his credit, it would really work. For the first 50 years of Plymouth Colony, there would be peace, an extraordinary event given the future history of America. And in many ways, Massasoit was the one that got his people through.
Yeah. You know, it struck me reading the story that, in a way, that treaty that was signed by John Carver and Massasoit was not unlike the Mayflower Compact.
Not at all. Yes, absolutely. And you know, what you see there is I think the power of their minister, John Robinson, being projected across 3,000 miles of ocean. John Robinson had been their leader in Leyden, Holland, and these pilgrims were more like a cult than most of us understand today. Robinson had controlled just about every aspect of their lives, and so in those documents you see his words reflected, and one of the great what ifs of this story is, what if Robinson, their spiritual leader, had made it over eventually, because he would end up dying in 1625, never make it to the New World, and this would cause a great sense of loss and sadness to come to Plymouth Colony, because the man who had been behind this original vision that had gotten them there would never make it.
Yeah, that treaty is very interesting. I don't know if you've got the book with you, Nathaniel, but page 99, maybe you would share just a couple of the points.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't have the book with me, actually, but I should. But, the points are, they point by point, they talk about, well, we will, if someone goes to war, this is between the English and the Wampanoags, and if a person goes to war against you, we will join you, come to your aid, and that's agreed. And they go point by point. For example, if tools get stolen, they will be returned, and a whole list of commitments to one another that will hopefully keep them together in the years to come.
Yeah, the final point, point six, when their men came to us, they should leave their bows and arrows behind them, as we should do our pieces when we came to them. So lay down your arms, and we will talk.
Right. Lay down your arms and we will talk. And, the arms were the big thing, because one of the reasons Massasoit looked to the English was their technology. And, they had muskets, which made large noises. And, and as a practical matter, they were not necessarily that much more effective than the bow and arrow in the New World, because a musket was very difficult to aim, to reload, and an Indian could get as many as five arrows into the air at one time, and yet there was a startle factor when it came to the muskets, and so they're talking about a peace with laying those various objects aside. And it's interesting, because 7 years later, in 1627, when a group of Dutch traders come to the settlement, they describe a typical Sunday in Plymouth Colony, and it begins with a kind of a march to the fort where they worship, and every man has his musket with him, and when they sit down in the fort to worship, every man has that musket at his side. No one was taking anything for granted when it came to personal safety in Plymouth Colony almost a decade after the arrival of the Mayflower.
Hmm. Nathaniel Philbrick is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Mayflower, A Story of Courage, Community, and War. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Eureka on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Interesting conversation. I came into the conversation a little bit late, maybe 15, 20 minutes into the program, but one of your guest remarks sort of struck me when I believe he said the pilgrims were more of a cult than most people realize, and I guess my understanding is not great, but I guess I thought there it was quite there was a lot of authoritarianism in the group. Could you elaborate on your previous comments about it being maybe somewhat cult-like?
Yeah. And they had spent, before they boarded the Mayflower, they had spent more than a decade in Leiden, Holland, and as religious exiles, a group of English people in Holland. And John Robinson had been their minister, and he had been elected by the congregation, but this was not a democratic society as you know we would think of it. Their religion was a part of everything, and their business life, everything flowed from the congregation, and so Robinson, as the spiritual leader, had his hand in just about every aspect of everyone's life. Where he lived, in the back of his house, was a large garden area, and they built little houses around it, more than a dozen of them. And so almost half the congregation lived on the grounds of his own property. And so, they were this little enclave in a very busy urban center in Holland, and their hope had been to take this little inner-directed world and transplant it to America. It became much more complicated, and that dream never was really fully realized.
Could I ask a follow-up, please?
Sure.
I guess when I think of strictness, I mean, sometimes it's in the eye of the beholder. I guess one issue I think that's fairly common is when persons don't maintain the standards and are subject to discipline, and I guess the ultimate would be expulsion, excommunication.
Mm-hmm.
Was this a very used tool in terms of keeping people in line?
It was, and we don't have the records to really determine how often that was used. But many times, if someone was felt that they were behaving improperly in a social situation or even in a business situation, elders in the congregation would speak with them and warn them. And this also applied to religious factors, and would warn them. And if they changed their behavior in a way that was seen as proper, things were fine. But if they didn't, they could then get expelled from the congregation. And there was a real discipline that was insisted upon, and not only in terms of how they worshipped, which was constantly on a Sunday and just about every day of the week was devoted to some kind of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
This was a very rigorously maintained little society.
Could I ask just one more short follow-up?
Sure.
Was Jonathan Edwards directly descended from the Pilgrims?
I don't think so, but I cannot say that with any authority. He's
He
probably came over from the Puritans up north in Boston.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Nathaniel Philbrook, author of Mayflower, A Story of Courage, Community, and War. Another listener called in and left his question with us, and that is, have you seen the movie The New World that came out last year, and what do you think of it?
You know, I have not seen it, and that was almost purposeful because Jamestown is the other story, and Jamestown is coming up on its 400th anniversary, and the movies are so powerful in terms of images and getting inside your head that I have really wanted to maintain my sense of it, but I will definitely try to see it soon at some point.
Yeah. The caller from Eureka raised a couple of interesting points. Among them, how were tensions and rivalries handled?
Yeah.
How were they handled? This is also an issue for Massasoit and Native Americans.
Oh, absolutely. And this is the thing that surprised me is how hard both sides worked at dealing with conflict. And at one point, early on, and this is an internal thing, it's their first Christmas in Plymouth Colony, and the strangers who are from members of the Church of England are used to celebrating Christmas. It's a holiday. You play games and those kinds of things. But if you're a Puritan separatist, that's not what you do. You don't believe in these kinds of holidays because there's no precedence for them in the scriptures. And so you do not celebrate. You work as you always should. And so Bradford leads his men to work building houses, while the separatists insist that, you know, they do as they do back in England and take the day off. And when Bradford returns for lunch, the streets of Plymouth are in bedlam as the strangers play stool ball. And Bradford's outraged. He says, if you take the day off, you better pray, you better not play, and takes their bats and balls away. And he lays down the law. And it's kind of startling for these Church of England people to realize that, in terms of Plymouth, it's illegal to do as they do in the mother country. And you know, this is pretty startling stuff, and yet it would become the way it was done in Plymouth Colony.
Mm. And among the Native Americans, Massasoit, in part, he was interested in a peace with these settlers so as to protect his people from other Native groups.
Absolutely. I mean, we have a tendency to see this as a monolithic English versus monolithic Native American perspective. And the fact of the matter is there was a multitude of perspectives within each group. And the Wampanoags were fearful that the Narragansetts were going to take them over, and so that the Pilgrims provided them with a way to have some kind of parity relative to them. And yet, you know, it was the Pilgrims had to deal with the Narragansetts as well. And in one situation, a few decades after the arrival of the Mayflower, some servants come across a Native American trader and kill him and steal his goods. And it's figured out who has committed these murders, and Bradford decides that the servants must be tried for murder. And many of the English are outraged. How can you bring an Englishman to trial for killing just an Indian? You know, this shouldn't be. And Bradford says, no, we must do this because the Indians are justifiably outraged by this because it was Narragansett and Wampanoags. Both attend the trial. The servants are found guilty and executed. And you know, this is pretty extraordinary when you come to the prejudices that were already rife within English culture. And both Bradford realized that if they did not take this seriously, they would undermine the basis upon their alliance. And if they undermine the alliance, who knows what could happen? And of course, that would happen come the second generation.
Yeah. Second generation comes along, the alliance starts to fall apart after 50-some years. When and why? Why, I guess. We've mentioned now here when, but why did things fall apart?
Well, you know, this really is a generational story. The first generation realized that both English and Indians alike needed each other if they were going to survive, if they were going to maintain their independence as a people. But the second generation grew up in very different circumstances. By the middle of the 17th century, they no longer regarded the other as essential to their survival in New England. The young English began to covet the lands that the Indians still possessed, while the Indians, young warriors of the Indians, began to say, you know, we've given up our forefathers' legacy here, and our future prosperity is being taken over by the English. And so both sides began to say, you know, hey, we're here. The other is a liability rather than a necessity. And you know, what they both missed was the fact that in actuality they did still need each other, because when the war would erupt, it would be a horrible conflict that would just kill thousands of people, and the English would ultimately win, but it was no victory. They had destroyed what had been a remarkably bicultural community, and in doing that would lay the groundwork for a series of Indian wars that would ravage New England for a century to come.
Yeah. Two sons, two tragic figures, Philip,
yes,
son of Massasoit, and Josiah Winslow, son of Pilgrim Edward Winslow.
Absolutely, and you know, and this becomes, in many ways, for me, it's a lesson in leadership and the what can happen when two leaders fail to take diplomatic means to a conflict. Philip was the son of Massasoit, and he believed that Josiah Winslow, governor of Plymouth Colony, had been directly responsible for the death of his older brother, Wamsutta, also known as Alexander. And for his part, Josiah Winslow distinguished himself as one of the more unscrupulous purchasers of native land. He would get Indians in debt and use that as a means to acquire vast tracts. And so these two people hated each other. And when tensions reached the boiling point in June of 1675, they were loath to take the diplomatic route, and as a consequence, both sides found themselves in the middle of a war that most people wanted no part of, that most people were astonished that this had happened, given a half century of peace. And it's the tragedy is that it did not have to happen. There had, even after violence broke out, even after a group of men, women, and children on the English side were killed and their bodies horribly mutilated, there was still the chance to stop it right there. But instead, anger, fear took over the English, and they began to see every Native American as a potential foe.
Yeah. Also, the politics of it is very interesting, mm-hmm. because they managed to hold it down. They managed to hold it off. But then again, on both sides, there seems to be a stirring up for political purposes.
Oh, absolutely. And it's political purposes on both sides. Philip, for example, his warriors were growing increasingly indignant, and he would use the promise of war as a political scheme to quiet them. But the war was always in the future, and he would always find very creative, sometimes humiliating ways of avoiding that conflict, because he knew if they ever did get into a serious war with the English, it could be the destruction of his people. And on the English side, the threat of the Indians became a way for them to say, everyone wanted more land. There was more and more English people, children looking for farms of their own, and with one way to acquire land is in warfare, and so there were political reasons for pushing this into a conflict on both sides, and unfortunately, it did lead to the virtual destruction of New England.
Yeah, with the Indian Wars, New Englanders were defeating themselves, because in the end, they had to call on the British for help, something that they set out to escape.
Exactly. They destroyed their forefathers' way of life because they had created this Puritan enclave where they were, in many ways, virtually independent of the mother country. They did not have an English governor. They were free to do as they wanted, and this was extraordinary. And in many ways, they were more independent than the subsequent generations would ever be. But by fighting this war with their native neighbors, they crippled themselves with debt. They burned more than a third of the towns were burned and abandoned, and they had to look to the mother country for financial support. And there was soon a royal governor in New England, and everything changed. And so this was not a victory by any means. They really destroyed everything their forefathers had struggled on so heroically in many ways to create. And so, for me, this is what the story of the Mayflower and the Pilgrims is really all about. It's an intergenerational story in which the promise of this new beginning on both sides, creating a new kind of society for both groups, is completely crushed.
Yeah. So for the New Englanders, we have death and dependency. We have impoverishment. On the Native American side, we have even greater casualties.
Yeah.
And enslavement.
Mm-hmm.
And again, an end of a way of life.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's the thing. when you look at the English losses, it's horrendous. More than twice the casualties of the American Civil War. You know, I mean, this is a war beyond our imaginings. But when you look to the Indian side, it's five times worse than that. When it came to Philip's band, they were known as the Poconokets, Wampanoags in the area of modern Bristol and Warren, Rhode Island. After this war, they were virtually obliterated as a people. Those that were not killed were shipped off as slaves, sent to the sugar plantations in the Caribbean. There would be more than 500 Indian slaves shipped out from Plymouth Colony alone, more than 1,000 in New England, throughout New England. And so you have what had been the crowded native heart of Plymouth Colony there on Mount Hope Peninsula, emptied of its native people, and subsequently, and to show you how this had completely devastated Plymouth Colony, there was no one in Plymouth Colony in a position to purchase this property, and so it was a group of Boston investors who ended up buying it, and it would then become the towns of Bristol and Warren, Rhode Island, and it's just a conflict which served no purpose on either side. It just fractured a community and created this what if in my mind. You know, what if this hadn't happened? Could it have been a different kind of New England? Could it have been a different kind of America?
Yeah. Well, how do you answer that question when you ask it?
Well, you know, my cynical side says, well, you know, if there had been no war, the gradual forces out there, largely fueled by real estate, would have made the end result not much different from what it would ultimately become. However, I don't know if I really believe that, because King Philip's War changed everything when it came to attitudes of race in New England. The English didn't necessarily, it wasn't a benign embrace of two cultures by any means. This was had been 55 years of struggle and compromise. The English didn't really understand the Indians, and the Indians didn't really understand the English. And yet they managed to live and work together. But after King Philip's War, this coexistence, this understanding of each other, was completely blown apart and replaced with real racial bigotry and fear and hatred. If that's not there, there is a potential for a different kind of attitude towards race and native peoples.
We have to wrap up here, but I do have one last question. Why is it that history like this essentially becomes lost to us?
Well, I think something like King Philip's War just does not fit comfortably into our preconceived vision. Course of American history. It begins with the Mayflower, and then it leapfrogs 150 years to the American Revolution. That's the next significant event in American history, and leaving this 150 year gap. And so we have the benign beginning, and then we have the inspirational war revolution for freedom and liberty, and a war such as King Philip's War just doesn't fit between the two. It doesn't fit our preconceived vision of America's beginnings. And the fact of the matter is, all that bloodshed of the 19th century as the West was won was prefigured in the 17th century New England.
There we'll leave it. There's so much more we could talk about. There's so many amazing characters in this story. I'm sorry we didn't get to more names, but I think we've covered the basics.
Yeah. No, it's been a lot of fun. I really appreciate this. Yeah.
You're very welcome. Our thanks this afternoon to historian Nathaniel Philbrick, the author most recently of Mayflower, A Story of Courage, Community, and War. The book is published by Viking. Our guest, by the way, won the National Book Award for his book, In the Heart of the Sea. That book tells the true story of Melville's inspiration for Moby Dick. And for his book, Sea of Glory, about the U.S. exploring expedition's circumnavigation of the globe in the first half of the 19th century, Nathaniel Philbrick was honored with the Theodore and Franklin Roosevelt Naval History Prize. The latest book, Mayflower, A Story of Courage, Community, and War, published by Viking.